Welcome to the Consulting Growth Podcast. I'm Professor Joe Omani, a professor of consulting at Cardiff University and an advisor to consultancies that want to grow. If you'd like to find more out about me and access some free resources to help your consultancy grow, do please visit joeomani.com. That's joeomahoney.com. Hello, welcome to the Growth Podcast. I have the pleasure today of having Matt Chong, who is the CEO of Clarisys, on with me. Matt's done a really remarkable job with Clarisys, and we'll talk more about the company shortly. Matt's background was in CRM, and then just over 10 years ago, he jumped to start and grow Clarisys into what is now 200, you may correct me in a second, but 200 employees, and really focusing on customer and employee insights and the digital transformation that is needed to support this. I made contact with Matt really indirectly through three of the consultants that work for Clarisys, and I was looking for support with some of the charities that I and my students work with. And I'd never met three consultants who are so positive and enthusiastic about their firm and the culture and the mentoring that takes place. And it was so striking that I thought I would reach out to Matt and see if he could explain how on earth this happened. So, Matt, I really appreciate your time today.
Great to be here, Joe. Thanks for inviting me.
Did I guess anything wrong in the introduction?
I guess Clarisys as a whole looks at customer and employee experience rather than insights, I would say. I think we are about 185 people. It varies kind of month to month. And we're in London and Boston. So we have a small office in Boston. It's now about 20 people, which is growing quite quickly.
When you jumped to start Clarisys, did you see a gap in the experience market that you thought, there's clearly something I can do here? Or did you kind of need to experiment a little bit to find that niche?
So the market 11, 12 years ago was somewhat different from the market today. I don't think customer experience was really a thing. Employee experience certainly wasn't a thing. So Clarisys started really because Claudia, Chris and I felt that there was a gap in the market for consultants that could challenge their customers to state the business problem rather than to take kind of the order from the customer. Because we'd spent, Claudia and I certainly together had spent probably a year and a half, 2 years working on a big CRM transformation program where we found it very hard to find those people, which really are the root of success for that kind of transformation program. If you want your transformation to be successful, you actually have to be quite robust in asking what problem are you trying to solve with the statement from a business user, I want a flag that records the fact that it's Tuesday. Right? It's a nonsensical requirement in that example, right? Mm-hmm. And that needs to be challenged. And not everyone is brave enough to do that or structured enough to do that in a way that works in the long term.
And I guess also having the experience to know that that isn't a proper requirement.
No. So you don't. Our postulation when we started was that experience is not necessary to do a good job as a consultant. So our postulation when we started, and it's obviously the business has moved on a bit since then, but if you're going to understand how a business works, you need to use a set of analytical and logical skills on the information a business user is going to give you. And you shouldn't make the mistake of thinking that you know more than that business user about their business.
Okay, interesting. So experience could be a problem, actually, if you're too experienced.
Can be a problem in some ways. I think also we deliberately chose a segment of the market that where experience wasn't critical because we felt that that was a way to build a firm that allowed us to build our own culture from the start rather than kind of importing someone else's culture. And I guess our experience had been that we can access talent in the market at quite a junior level that often outperforms more experienced talent, potentially because there are a lot of preconceptions and rigid ideas. And at the time, we were very passionate about Agile, and Agile for the enterprise at that point was not really well understood. And so flexibility of mindset, et cetera, were probably more important than, I've got 15 years of experience of writing requirements, when actually we don't want someone to write requirements.
Sure.
Understand the problem.
Yes. And if you've got 15 years experience of writing requirements, you've really got to ask why you're still writing requirements after 15 years.
Well, I don't particularly. There are people who love doing that.
Yeah, there are,
And I think there is room for that. But my experience of being a consultant was that you can learn stuff very quickly. And part of the importance of being of growing your career is that you do new things and you're stretching yourself whilst repeating other things and becoming more expert at them. I think as a growing firm, and one of the features of the firm over those 10 years is that as people have grown and learned things within the firm does different things, right? Yeah. So we don't do so much process mapping and requirement user story definition as we used to. We do end-to-end really transformation of, so my customer is currently a bit fed up because he doesn't really understand where their order goes, where their sales process is. It's just genuinely a bad experience. How do I change that to the point where it's a great experience? And as a result, actually, the experience for the employee improves. And that's a different set of challenges from where we started. And it's only possible because people have built expertise in certain domains like sales or customer service or things like that, that now they can apply to say, okay, it's interesting that that looks like that at the moment. Have you thought about this? Your benchmark outside looks like this, but still retaining that humility of, and I know the joke of the consultant tells you the time by their own watch, but to some extent, it's important to listen to what the business is saying to you, because they are the ones that have to deal with everything, all the crap that comes from having a poorly designed process, poorly designed customer journey. And it's patronizing, frankly, to come to them and say, oh, you should just do it this way.
Yeah.
Because they've probably been through five or six transformations that have succeeded with varying degrees of success, and their screen is probably covered with a bunch of post-it notes. So what you're there to do is to make it better for the customer, but to also to listen to why things don't work as they might work. And maybe there's a brilliant idea sitting in someone's head who can't quite see how to execute on it. Because when you're in the day-to-day of working with a customer, you don't get the headspace to understand where the opportunity to transform is and how you might go about that transformation. And that's what we're good at.
That's really interesting. I cut my teeth on business process reengineering in the 90s. And obviously one of the big things that went, you know, there were lots of high profile failures. And one of the big reasons for that is that the business, as you called it earlier, the people who were listened to were the, in effect, the board, and who was forgotten about were the people who actually experienced the customer problems and the issues and the experience blockages. And I'm guessing you're good at releasing the energy and ideas of that layer below the board, I'm guessing, is what you focus on.
And I think aligning that with what the board wants to achieve and showing results change, that's part of why Agile is important, right? That in some of the reasons why BPRs used to fail was because you would design something up front, there was a complete wrenching transformation of everything, and then try and deploy it. And obviously it didn't work, right? Because what had been there before was there for a reason and had loads of workarounds in it that people didn't tell you about because they were things they didn't think were important. And by being more agile about it and saying, right, actually, we're going to improve this process. Where are we going to start? What are we going to do first? Where are we going to see results from? You get more chance of success. Now, the issue is that often you do have to do a wrenching transformation, but even when you're doing that wrenching transformation, you have to find a way to learn from what your first idea and your first design with the set of people that have helped you design it is, because let's be honest, it's going to be a bit right, it's going to be a bit wrong, it's going to need fixing. And I think that humility of accepting that transformation is not finite is quite important. Like, we have a habit of thinking we can finish. I don't think you ever finish transforming a business if it's a good business.
That's really nice to hear, especially after some of my early experiences in the 90s with BPR. I could have done with some of these messages, gosh, 30 years ago now, that's embarrassing. Brilliant. Okay, so we've got an idea of the niche and how that niche changed over the time from more process work to more experience work. Tell me about when you first started off. Was it Christopher and Claudia from the beginning, or did you jump at different times?
We all jumped at the same time. So when we started, we were all working for Clarisys at that point. I think the original idea turned up in the pub, and then we recruited Chris because we realized that we needed someone slightly more sane. And actually that set of diverse opinions was incredibly valuable for us in making sure that there was debate and we weren't kind of group thinking. Just diversity of thought is very powerful, actually.
Okay. Were you one of those lucky group of founders where you found that over time, as your roles needed to specialize, you very easily slotted into specific roles around the organization? Or did some of you struggle in the roles or move to different roles or actually end up focusing on delivery or sales rather than sort of director level?
We quite early decided that people had certain sets of skills, but also that there was an expectation that all of us would have to do some form of BD, some form of client relationship. I think for the first 3 years, all of us were still chargeable on client for all of that time, partly to take risk out of growing the business. People often ask, is it risky to start a business? It isn't if you're doing it on a cash flow basis and you're waiting for someone to be chargeable before you hire someone else. So I think as the firm grew, we had a particularly bumpy period. And out of that, we realized that, well, it was painful. And we had a bunch of team coaching where we talked about implicit and explicit roles a lot. And that helped us transform to be a lot more effective because each of us was carrying a different assumption about what each other was doing. And to some extent, by releasing those assumptions and saying, right, I'm actually not very good at X, so someone else do X, it takes a bunch of stress away. And that expectation that somebody should be doing Y and they're thinking, I don't want to do Y, I'm not good at Y, it makes me stressed, that removed a bunch of tension where perhaps we could have done that earlier, but I think that's part of learning how to be effective.
Sure. Correct me if I'm wrong, and I'd very much like you to, because this is more of a provocative question, but I guess, was that the first big sort of inflection point or challenge that you came across where, I mean, obviously there's the cash flow thing, but it sounds like you had a fairly logical approach to growth. Where was that the first inflection point or bump in the road that you came across, which is really that detailed discussion around roles and what you want to do? Or was there something different or earlier that you hit that you needed to overcome?
I think getting to 30 or 40 people was relatively straightforward. Good. And mildly naive. I think at that point, kind of conglomeration of factors ended up with a bit of a cash flow crisis. And getting through that cash flow crisis put an immense amount of strain on the three of us, which resulted in needing to do that team coaching to kind of heal a bunch of pain. And to be honest, my feeling is that that period of crisis was the catalyst for being successful in other ways since then. Without that, you're not forced to confront something that perhaps you needed to confront.
Amongst my own clients and those people I've interviewed, that sort of 30 employee stage appears to bring very often a transformation in the company, not just in terms of roles, but in terms of devolution of responsibilities, in terms of systems and processes that need to be set up. And very often that is addressed by bringing in a piece of software, and often that fails because they expect the software to be the magic bullet as opposed to actually having some of those difficult conversations. So I'm pleased you tackled that early on.
So we had software before that because of who we are.
Okay, of course, yes, yes.
So we had automated a lot of stuff, and I think there is an interesting point about the sizes where pain happens, and you see this in projects as well, where you see project managers who are very competent, say 10, 20, 30 person projects, and then you go past a certain point, maybe it's 60 or something, and the complexity suddenly explodes. Yeah. And their way of managing was based on possibly micromanaging, but possibly just luck to some extent.
Yes,
and it doesn't scale, right? If you can jump from 30 to 60, then it's highly likely you can jump from 60 to 150.
Yeah, sure.
And probably past that. But you were asking earlier about, or you were talking earlier about the fact that people within Claris are quite content with how the firm operates. One of the things that is important is looking at where are the breakpoints in terms of size that mean that it's hard for humans to relate to each other. If you think about Roman legions, they were 60, 80, and they were organized deliberately like that because that meant that you knew the people in the rest of your, whatever it was called, cohort, I guess. And Dunbar's number talks about something similar. So thinking about the growth of the firm in those contexts helps understand and anticipate where you might have an issue. You can't guarantee it. The other thing we've noticed is that going past 100 changed something significant about the way the rest of the market deals with Claris. So all of a sudden we started seeing more cold stuff coming in. Perhaps we're more credible. To when you go in to pitch for something, it becomes more viable from a client's point of view if actually you're not 30 people, you're 100 people. I think without question that's true. And equally, you're braver, right? So if you're 100 people, you can pitch for a project that is 20 people and that's 20% of the firm. That's okay, it's not great. But when you were 30 people, you couldn't have pitched for that project. So there's a change as you grow, and that's part of why I think it's important to get to a certain size. I think somewhere between 200 and 400 means you are sustainable for the long term. Whereas if you're, and if you look at the market, you'll see there is a bit of a death zone around that where there aren't that many firms above probably 400.
Yes. Well, by that stage, very often the founders have reached a certain age as well. I'm sure this isn't true of you because you look, much younger. But yes, very often founders will be getting to the 55 mark and be thinking, I want to spend more time with the family, which is something else I've seen. Listen, Matt, you mentioned the culture side of things and the coaching side of things. I'd really like to focus on that because it really stood out to me, as I said, how positive and motivated these three consultants who I spoke to, and they had no reason to, and I had no reason to think that I would end up talking to you. So it wasn't a sort of a puffery job. But how did, I guess two things. One, did you explicitly set out to think, okay, this is something we need to manage explicitly? And secondly, or achieve explicitly? And secondly, how did you go about it?
There are two things there, right? So one is, how do you look after your people? And the second is, do you care whether people are happy at work? The first one for me was kind of non-negotiable, right? I think if you look at industry, then it's pretty standard to have a one-to-one with your boss weekly, talk about your career. The time is for you, not if they're a forward-thinking boss, the time is for you, not for the boss. And it's about career growth. It's about dealing with the challenges you've got. Kind of the way I put it, I used to put it when I did all the interviews, was enabling you to be the best version of you, right? Now, my experience in consulting was that that doesn't happen. Now, consulting is a bit different from lots of industries in that you're on a project for a certain amount of time. You might have a team leader who is probably having a one-to-one with you, but they're focused on the next deadline, the quality of the deliverable you're looking at, that kind of thing. They're not focused on you as a person. So one of the things that we were dead set on when we started was that every single consultant would have, I don't think we called it coach at that time. I think it was probably a manager, but it would be a one-to-one with someone who was more senior than them. And that job was pastoral as opposed to deliverable focused. Now, sometimes it's quite hard to separate the two things because people need sometimes help with what they're doing from a client point of view. And in a small firm, you're sometimes their engagement lead and their coach. And that blurs the lines, particularly kind of in those early days. But that structure of everyone has a coach, that is about career growth. That's about what challenges do you face personally? What things can you unlock that you're blocked by but don't recognize? How do you take the next step? All of those kind of pure coachy questions really is deeply embedded across the firm. So we train people on neuroscience about how to coach and how to give feedback. There's a bunch of training around how do you develop those skills, and everyone is encouraged to coach. And I ask sometimes, what if someone doesn't want to coach? Well, that's nice for them, but then this is not the place for them.
Yeah.
That's been there since day one. It's got better and better. And I think long term, it would be lovely to move to a pure coaching model where none of the salary type discussion was part of the coach's responsibility because it makes it safer. Mm. But that's quite hard to do and would be quite radical. So that's a separate kind of track that ties into how you make people happy. So that was probably our biggest innovation when we started. And partly that was because we were taking on quite junior people who were going to need a lot of help, who were smart. And we knew that if we gave them enough framework to support them, then they'd be successful. To your point earlier, how do you know what's the right question to ask? Well, if you've got someone to bounce ideas off, then you're going to be able to figure out the right question to ask. Then, so Claudia is very passionate about having fun at work. Now, I didn't have much fun at work until I started Clarisys, so I was a bit more skeptical about this. But if you reduce it, you spend a lot of your time at work. You should be able to be happy at work. You shouldn't be miserable. You shouldn't be on a Sunday night full of anxiety, not wanting to go on Monday morning. You shouldn't hate your boss. You should have a productive environment at work that makes you happy, because you will produce better output and it's better for you. And then there's a bunch of other metrics you could measure, like sick days and stuff like that. But fundamentally, morally, it's better that someone is happy at work than they're just miserable, because the dark satanic mills are 100 plus years ago, and there's no need to beat people around the head to tell them to do a good job, right? Yeah. People are motivated in different ways than that. They just want to do a good job because they want to improve themselves and achieve things. So if you get to that, then you have to think about, well, okay, what motivates people? And we use what was popularized by Daniel Pink, but has roots elsewhere in terms of intrinsic and extrinsic motivation and belonging, and figure out how are you going to achieve those things, right? So how are you going to enable autonomy? How are you going to deliver mastery? How are you going to deliver purpose? How do you kind of make some of the intrinsic things less important, like pay and kind of grade? So this probably wasn't there in those first few years. I think in the first few years, you're building a startup. People join the startup because it's a thing. Equally, I did an interview the other day with, I'm writing a book about Claritas, and I did an interview with a couple of people from within the firm, and half of the people say, I was just delighted I got given a job. I think as you're building that startup, people are joining because it's different from everywhere else. And then probably around that 30, 40, 50 mark, and particularly forced upon us by understanding that accepting the way the outside world operates and just copying that model isn't necessarily going to result in success, and there's no real reason why that model exists, forces you to look at it from more from first principles and say, what is it we're trying to build and why are we trying to build that? And so then you look at some of the things we'd already done at that point, and defining values was somewhere before that crisis to say, okay, trust is pretty fundamental to how the firm works, right? But basically, when we started, we just say, well, do whatever is right for the client and whatever is right for you, because actually, if you balance that set of things out, you can make a sensible decision, and you're going to want to bounce those ideas off other people, right? That's part of being independent, autonomous. And I don't think we thought it through like that, but fundamentally, the firm runs on trust, right? That you're going to recognize when you're out of your depth, and then you're going to go and ask for help. And that enables us to enable autonomy for people, because then people can make a lot of their own decisions using advice from other people. So growing out of the intrinsic extrinsic model was a bunch of stuff about, okay, the way annual appraisals work, we don't really like that. We don't really like the way approvals work. We don't really like a bunch of hierarchical behavior. And we certainly like transparency, and we don't like old boys clubs, and we don't like smoke-filled rooms, and we don't like a lot of the rubbish that just comes for no particular reason. And some of that is because traditional ways of compensating people based on individual rewards focus people on the individual and not on the team. And I find that hard to accept in a modern business because... Right, sales guy has gone and had a difficult conversation with the client to win the deal, but then the people who deliver the deal are the one that makes that successful, and the sales guy wouldn't have had the conversation without the fact the team before did a good job and so created the reputation. So individual compensation does not work if you want a team-based model where people help each other to succeed. And if you want people to be happy, then they need to feel belonging, so you need a team-based model so they're not constantly stabbing each other in the back. That's obviously a parody of a far broken organization, but those exist where they are deeply unpleasant and they make people miserable because people feel unfairly dealt with just by getting on with their job rather than dealing with some stuff that makes them miserable.
Yes.
So that is where we went. We went towards team and we went towards being driven by values. And then over the last probably 2-3 years, we've doubled down on that to say some ideas reinventing organizations by Frederick Laloux. He talks about teal organizations and how there are various evolutions and democratizing and distributing decision-making and authority deliver on a lot of those individual requirements. And we've also been influenced by what corporate rebels have been doing and taking examples from Burt's Org and Hire and places like that to say, well, how do you organize in a way that enables that motivation model? And so that this is in no way finished, right? It's the point about kind of transformations never finishing, an evolution over time and the organization as an organism or as a system of organisms will adapt and change over time. And it's inevitable that whilst people love the culture now and want to maintain it, that culture will change because people change, times change, and, you know, when we started, no one had any children within the firm. Now there are lots of parents, right? So different things are applicable at different times. The world around us changes. So we have to adapt to that and accept that some things, you have to be careful that you're holding on to things for the right reasons, as opposed to just because that's where it was and we liked it like that.
It's a really interesting point throughout, but especially at the end around change and how especially people's strategy in your type of firm is influenced by, as you said, times changing, but I guess more specifically, the investment horizons of the owners, because David Meister kind of pointed out. He had three types of firms: the brain firm, the process firms, and the experience-based firms. Very much said, you know, with the process firms, and actually you'd be now be perhaps more in the brain side of things now that you're focusing more on experience. There's margins to be made by almost cutting back on the, in those days would have been seen as the fluffy side of things. But anyone that's had any experience with that type of firms knows the economic payback of treating your people right and developing your people, because they stay longer, they perform better, they sell your firm for you, they believe what they're selling. My experience with your three guys caused me to reach out to you. It wouldn't have happened in 95% of other firms that I've spoken to. But I'm guessing, and do feel free to say, we haven't made that decision or I don't want to discuss it or whatever, but long term, I guess that the importance of the people and investing time and money into the people side of things might influence where you get capital from for growth in future, because I can imagine with some firms who float on the stock exchange, very often the investment horizon becomes tomorrow. And so investors will be saying, well, that hour you spend on development each week, that could be charged out. So if that's something that plays in the back of your head, have you not got to that stage yet?
So we are 60% owned by an employee ownership trust. We did not want the set of external pressures to start impacting the way we make decisions. Mm. When we're looking at how do we exit founders, so Chris and Claudia are now non-execs, it took us a while to find a mechanism that was going to work. So you look at private equity and, okay, yep, there are firms out there that will take a long view, but you're still going to be driven differently.
Yep.
They've still got an external target. Stock exchange, obviously you're reporting quarterly, sure, etc. I just don't fancy it. We take an extremely long view to the point where you might argue at times we should probably be slightly more commercial, but investment horizon is probably 10 years. And the EOT is there to kind of say, we're not interested in being bought by anyone else. We have deliberately set out to build this firm in a way that people want to work here and clients want to work with us, and we are different as a result. And okay, it could be about money, but there's only so much money. Yes, I would make a lot more money if we'd sold to private equity.
Yes.
But I think for all three of us, we would feel like we were betraying some element of the trust and bargain we make with the people who join the firm, right? So ending up with an EOT, which is vendor debt backed, is, I think, the best possible outcome we could have found.
It's really putting your money where your mouth is so that people know you're credible. I mean, it's one thing if I was a potential employee looking at the firm and, you know, I look at your website and you say all these wonderful things, but everyone says all these wonderful things. Now, I could also look on Glassdoor where you guys excel compared to pretty much any other peer that you have. But certainly when it comes to ownership, that's really an indication that the owners are taking it seriously, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, it created some interesting dynamics because we are very distributed in terms of decision-making authority, and you add in the regulations around T boards and how they relate to the board itself are quite designed for a top-down organization. You actually have to re-engineer it to meet the regulatory need, but not to break your bottom-up decision-making process, which took a while to get people used to, because as soon as you create a board, people think that's important. Actually, it's not that important.
And do you mind just giving us a brief indication of how it works in terms of whether it's reward-based or whether it's longevity-based or whether people can buy in?
The trust owns 60% of the shares of Clarisys for the benefit of employees. That means is initially, because the trust bought the shares with debt, it has to pay off the debt first. So at the moment, the main benefit to employees is that profit share, which was there before the EOT. So the interesting thing is we have a lot of the things that EOTs would like to have before we became an EOT. So in effect, we were already operating like that. The profit share becomes tax-free up to a $7,000+ limit. And to be honest, in the short term, that's the only benefit beyond the kind of slightly intangible ones of the trust owns it for the benefit of employees. So it has authority over appointing directors and it has a golden share in takeover conversations. But like my stock response is no to anybody who emails me anyway. So
it's nice to be asked though, isn't it?
when the trust has paid back its debt, the profit associated with that 60%, according to our model, then becomes available to the trust to spend. So we've had for a long time a kind of set formula for distributing profits. So we make sure we reinvest in the firm, we share profit, and then we look after the shareholders. In 3-4 years, when the trust has paid back its debt, then that kind of 60% becomes available, and actually that makes a material difference to profit share. I wish it would be quicker, but depending on the firm making money in
any it incentivizes the right, it does take longer, but it does incentivize some of the right behaviors around investment horizons, but also employees staying a bit longer, perhaps. It's also a good, speaking personally, it's useful for some of my clients who are looking at the horizon and there's going to be some type of equity event happening sooner or later, and they very often have that challenge. They've built this beautiful thing and it's more of a family atmosphere, and they've invested in the people, and they're quite concerned about, you know, the options and how that will impact the firm. And it's great to see something that's working so well. One final question I always ask my guests, if you don't mind, and that is, and there's so much you've done right, if there's anything that you would change in terms of, and it could be, you know, fairly minor stuff or strategic decisions, or specifically around growth and growth challenges, if there's anything you would have liked to have known before you embarked on the journey, or any important lessons that you've learned.
Interesting. I would have started scenario planning from the beginning, I think. So scenario planning is, you take, here's my central projection of what's going to happen over the next year, 2 years, 3 years, and then here are 3 or 4 other things that could happen. That's what this looks like. So, and that doesn't have to be clever. That could just be, this is what happens if we make no money this year. This is what happens if we make 5% margin. This is what happens if we make 10% margin. And actually being arbitrary about it helps quite a lot, because otherwise you get bogged down in, what does the price of wheat make a difference? Well, it doesn't matter, because actually you can't 100% influence what's going to happen. And sometimes you can confuse yourself by believing you are more in control of your destiny than you actually are. But doing that allows you to understand the impact of the decisions you're going to make. So should I hire 5 people this year? Well, we've hit our projection so far. Actually, we're on our best case scenario, and that means we can afford to do it. And this is what that's going to do to that scenario over time. That would have spotted our financial crisis. It worked incredibly well through COVID last year, where we kind of could see what was going to happen a long way in advance, and were able to communicate to everyone within the business, if these things happen, this is what we're going to do. If this happens, then X. It gives people certainty in a very uncertain environment. Now, had we done that, we might have avoided that cash flow crisis, but that then might have meant that we didn't transform in the way we have. So I don't know whether I would have changed it, actually. I think having it in place helps us a lot now. Perhaps having it right at the beginning wouldn't have helped us. Sometimes it's just pure belief, right? We're going to build a firm. We're going to see what happens. And what's the worst that can happen? Because if we've built a firm successfully, the people who've joined have learned from that. They were good enough to get a job with us. They'll be able to get a job elsewhere. So the worst case scenario when you're growing is actually not as bad as you could catastrophize it to be. However, if one of the big things we changed between our response in that cash flow crisis to the COVID crisis is the amount of transparency. The worst thing you can do is ride to the edge of the cliff and not tell anyone you're approaching the cliff. Because if you get to the edge of the cliff and the bridge isn't there, then you basically, the day before payday, and you're not going to be able to pay people's wages. That is a catastrophe for those people involved, right? And you sometimes see people, I've seen a number of reviews that where people are upset that they haven't been paid their salaries. And from the other side, I think that happens because the leaders of those firms think they are protecting the people from the stress of that uncertainty of, is the firm going to survive? But that's not treating them as adults or valuing how they contribute to the firm. So by switching that to treating people as adults, able to make their own decisions about whether to stay or whether to go, takes away that risk of taking all that responsibility on your own shoulders and going, oh, we're going to go bust, or we're not going to go bust, but not telling anyone. And you run the risk of that terrible moment where someone's not being paid for something you knew there was a chance it's going to happen, but you didn't tell them. Versus, right, this is where our cash flow is. This is what it's going to look like. You make your decision, and maybe you can help, because maybe you can go on sabbatical. Maybe you can volunteer to sacrifice salary or whatever. And that was the fundamental difference between our first disaster response and our second disaster response, and that was enabled by scenario planning. Yeah. And for me personally, that was a much nicer place to be and a lot less stressful.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Yes, and I think there's a lot that smaller firms can learn from that. You know, you could, as you say, you can't predict the wheat price in the Ukraine or necessarily even COVID, but you can plan for scenarios of margins and revenues and things like that. And how things are communicated, and I often see this further down the line when a firm is approaching sale and they keep it quiet from everyone, but everyone knows what's going on.
Yes.
Or they fear the worst, as you say. They don't necessarily know what's going on, but they fear that the company, that these people arriving in suits are actually administrators as opposed to somebody who's going to be buying the firm.
Yeah, if you don't communicate something, people make up something in their head. Yeah, sure. And you have no idea what that is.
Matt, listen, thank you so much for your time. We've learned a huge amount from you, and it's going to be really interesting to see what happens over the next few years with you. But many thanks.
Thanks very much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
As ever, thank you for listening to the Consultancy Growth Podcast. This is Professor Joe Omani at joeomani.com.